Welcome to the latest episode of the Enterprise Times Security Podcast Series. My name is Ian Murphy. My guests today are Ryan Alston, Vice President, Threat Intelligence at Uni42 Palo Alto Networks, and Scott Daly, Director of Security Operations Center US at NTT Limited. We're going to talk about supply chain threats, what they are, and what they mean for organizations. Ryan and Scott, welcome to the podcast.
I'm Ryan Olson. As Ian mentioned, I lead Unit 42, the global threat intelligence team for Palo Alto Networks. I've been on Palo Alto Networks for about 7 years now. I founded this team specifically to look at all of the data that our company collects to try to better understand adversaries. And with that information, we share with our internal team so that we can make products better. We also publish reports to the world so that we can help shine a light on threats that we think are important. Altogether, the team is spread out all over the world and focus on all sorts of different threats, including at the top end where we see advanced adversaries all the way down to the run-of-the-mill cybercrime, trying to really cover all the bases for our customers.
Hello, everybody. I'm Scott Daly. I'm the Director of the Security Operations Center for the Americas region for NTT Limited. We are a managed security services company, and we monitor client networks on their behalf to ensure that they are protected. We work a lot with companies like Palo Alto to try to gain as much information as we can about the threats out there in the wild so that we can use them to further our alerting and further that mission of ensuring that our clients are protected.
After the global impact of NotPetya, the security industry started talking about supply chain threat and why NotPetya was so devastating. Here we are again. Let's look at SolarWinds, another supply chain attack. This one, unlike NotPetya, was meant to happen. But the impact on governments and tech industry has been completely out of proportion to what we expected. Before we talk about why we're back there again, let's define what a supply chain attack is.
In this case, we're specifically thinking about software supply chain attacks. The supply chain can mean a lot of things when we think about hardware. When it comes to the software supply chain in particular, sometimes people don't realize that there are a lot of components that go between a programmer sitting down and writing code until it's actually executing on your system. Someone writes some code, typically many people who are involved in that project. It's then stored somewhere, typically in a source code repository. From there, it's built, which might mean compiling. It might mean shipping it to another server. Oftentimes, there's a signing process that goes into it. Libraries get pulled in so that different capabilities of the software don't have to be written over and over again. Eventually, it needs to be distributed to you, and that can be through many different forms. Sometimes it comes built into a computer that you bought. Sometimes it's downloaded from the internet. Sometimes it's on a CD or in some other way. This is where SolarWinds came in. Software gets updated on a regular basis. That same supply chain that goes in from writing the code through compilation into distribution, that occurs for an update as well, where your system goes out to a website in some way and downloads a compiled binary and then executes on your system. We've seen a lot of software supply chain attacks that have happened in the past. NotPetya mentioned earlier, SolarWinds, these are some of the major ones, but these attacks are not new. The concept of them has been around for a long time, going back over 30 years, back to Ken Thompson's original paper on reflections on trusting trust, where he thought about and discussed, can you really trust compilers? Someone had to write a compiler. If you don't know what the compiler is doing, if you haven't seen its source code, how can you trust what is coming from your own source code once it is compiled?
The great thing to talk about here, Ryan, is that there is an inherent amount of trust that just by existing in the IT space, most IT folks have. I trust that when I go to update Google Chrome or Mozilla or whatever, that the update is good and I don't have to check and validate that. Scale that up to the enterprise level, there is even more trust in the sense that if I'm buying products or software from a supplier, that their house is in order from a security standpoint. And when I put their software in my environment, that it's not going to cause me to do harm. That's the linchpin of why supply chain attacks are so damaging. We talked a little bit about this before, where part of the objective of a supply chain attack is to turn your target into knots, trying to figure out if they have other software in their environment that's also corrupted or is owned by a different party than they thought. It's one of those things that starts from a place of really inherent trust. We see this a lot with our clients. There's an enormous amount of trust that they place in vendors. I think we can all agree that the average company today has more vendors from a IT perspective to keep track of these days than there ever has been. And there's not a lot of emphasis put on the whole trust but verify and checking those binaries, checking the compile code that you're getting, because there's always a huge rush to get that new update out. We've got to be in compliance and we have to do it by this date. all of those things combine to be perfect storm. And SolarWinds has a great example of that, where there was an inherent amount of trust, I mean, all the way up to the U.S. government, the Treasury Department, so on. They were trusting that SolarWinds had their stuff in order to ensure that their software wasn't corrupted. And when it got corrupted, it turned everybody in knots trying to figure out exactly how bad it was and then trying to go remediate that. It's kind of a double whammy, but it starts from a place of trust. What a lot of folks need to get right with is that anytime there's a trust mechanism out there, you have my trust until you don't. Now that SolarWinds has happened, it's one of those questions that we kind of have to ask ourselves, is it worth it to go back and check everything that's in your environment? That's a lot of effort.
But it's more complex than that, though, isn't it? This whole issue of, I trust vendor A because they're a very large vendor. I trust vendor B because they're equally large. I don't check the package software they send me. I don't check the code when I'm using their APIs in order to integrate other products. What I do rely on is them giving me patches and updates in a timely basis. If we go back 15, 20 years, we used to take the view that we checked a lot of those updates before we applied them. Now we're in a phase where we're told to just apply them automatically. And that's perhaps with SolarWinds is what allowed it to become so devastating so quickly.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. The bigger the vendor is, the more folks that use their software, it's going to be a bigger impact. I remember very clearly when I used to work for the DoD, one of the things that is a DoD requirement is that we checked every bit of software that came into the environment before it got loaded on our network. There was a process in place to validate all those things. There were teams in place to ensure that that software matched up to what was called the STIG, the Security Technical Implementation Guide, which is a set of guidelines that certain flags have to be turned off. The code can only come from these places, so on and so forth. In a way, a lot of companies need to look at an automated mechanism for that process, but a process nonetheless that gives them at least the comfort to go to bed at night saying that, hey, we did what we could. We checked everything that we could. Are we going to bust open the compiler and look at every single binary in there? That might be a little extreme for most things, but on major updates, maybe. A lot of companies don't really do that level of testing or testing at all. That's one of those things that where you set yourself up to get really bitten hard.
Yeah, Scott, could you even go to the layer of understanding the entire chain of how software was written, how it was compiled, every single library, every single update? I'm not sure it's even feasible in the modern context. It's helpful to take a step back and look at your software, look at the sourcing on it, and question your vendors about what they're doing to try to keep their software as secure as possible and expect them to do that. But prepare for a situation where any software in your network may be compromised and think about what you would do in those scenarios. As we were in the wake of SolarWinds, one of the things that flipped for a lot of people was when we used to hear about a breach for a software provider, our first question was, has their user data been stolen? That's the initial question that you would ask. Then we switched over to start thinking about, if a big software vendor has just announced they experienced a compromise, has their software now been compromised as well? Could a huge vendor like Microsoft, who was impacted by the SolarWinds attack, had their software compromised as well? That doesn't appear to have been the case here, but that's the level at which we need to be thinking about the potential impact of one of these threats. And not just what could you do if it was a software supply chain attack, but it's really the same for an insider threat. If you have an insider who's in your network, who has access, has legitimate privileges, but is abusing them, how would you detect them going out of bounds? That really comes down to a couple things in my mind. One is the concept of zero trust has been kicked around for quite a long time now, but architecting networks so that systems can only access the data and other systems that they need to, and only for those specific purposes, would have been very beneficial for anyone who is looking to prevent SolarWinds from impacting their systems, as well as beyond the network on individual endpoints. How do you ensure you have complete visibility in what's happening, what's going on those systems, what software is running, when is a system deviating from its normal activity, might help you identify when there actually has been a compromise or even just somebody who's acting abnormally, doing something they weren't supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I agree. That brings up two thoughts in my head. We see this all the time with our customers in the sense that when you mention architecting the network so that it's easy to put a lot of these protections in place, a lot of our customers, we say the same kind of thing to them, but they turn around and say, well, that's great, NTT, thanks for the advice, but we acquire 3 to 4 companies a year. And with those companies that we acquire their network. What do you say to that? The only response we have is it's worthwhile to have a really, really good network architect on staff, or at least somebody that you trust from a third-party perspective. Have somebody on your staff or somebody that you can utilize to architect your network in such a way that if you do grow by acquisition or you grow by combining with other companies, if you have a network architecture that is suitable to plug these new variants in, that's really a big deal. We always find there is a balance. And I think this whole conversation is going to end up in a place where everybody agrees that doing those things is really, really important. It's easy for us to sit back and say, because we live and breathe this stuff every day, but from a business aspect, a dollars and cents aspect, that's really expensive. It's a running conversation that we have with our clients constantly. The other thought I had is up until probably, I would say about 6 months to a year ago, most vendors were loath to tell you what testing they go through, what software validation they go through. They'll say, read the release notes. Everything's there. No, it's not. It's a mental shift that vendors have to start thinking about to say, I need to expose my testing criteria. I need to expose the security architecture of this software that I have built into it. Now, how do I do that without really exposing the keys?
But it's much more complex than that in many ways. Around the 2000 era, Microsoft introduced a program called Certified for Windows 2000. It was the first vendor to look to force all software that was going to run on its platforms to go through a set of verified tests. If you were a third party, the only way you could do this was to download the test libraries, run them, and then submit them for verification. One of the reasons for that was because as a third party, there were a whole bunch of deprecated libraries that you were not allowed to use and deprecated technologies that you could no longer implement. Microsoft took the position that it had a lot of customers on older software that it needed to support. Therefore, it had to continue supporting those libraries and technologies in its own software. So it could never be compliant with what it wanted third parties to do. How much do we need a root and branch rethink by software vendors so that when they start to say to third parties and to their customers, this is best practice, they actually stand up and demonstrate that this is best practice because they are doing it themselves?
That's a really interesting question because it is a complete mental shift. The development that we do at NTT, talking to the folks in our CTO organization, a lot of the emphasis is on being agile, getting your sprints down to 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, so you can push product out the door consistently. There's a lot of pressure on developers of any type and stripe to achieve a product launch, whether it's an update, new feature, new enhancement, whatever. But that has to be balanced against, is the code that we're writing for this new thing that we're building done in a secure manner? Does it fit into the overall security architecture? That's been honestly a struggle that we have at NTT. When we go to put this stuff into a testing environment and really just kick the tires pretty hard, every now and again, we uncover some of these things and it has to go back to the drawing board. From a developer's perspective, I could completely understand and see and empathize with the frustration of, I've got to get this product out the door, but I've got to do it securely. There's only so much time in the day, so am I going to be working 15, 16-hour days?
I think it's also important to think about how much the world of software has changed in the last 20 years and how much it will likely continue to change for the next 20 years. The idea that software is going to be compiled and distributed and run on your local operating system on your laptop is very different from you accessing a cloud service through your web browser and what the impact of that means. If a service is completely provided to you as a software as a service over the web, all of the code that goes into operating on that data, keeping that data secure, and the code that could be potentially compromised and give somebody else access to it, you can't view that code. It's not running on your system. You're not going to go and reverse engineer that and go and understand it. It's not even running on a host that you own. It's running out in the cloud. That's an element of software supply chain that has to be kept in mind. If you're just using a web browser to access the majority of your software, maybe even just from a Chromebook or something like that, all of that development and integration process and all the security of that is a continuous integrated process for the vendor in keeping everything secure all the way from the development of the code, all the way through the deployment and operation of the infrastructure. They own that end to end. And it really is a different model. It's one that's accelerating, and I don't think we'll necessarily be able to think about former paradigms around how we would secure code necessarily, secure operating systems in 2030 and beyond.
But that raises two questions. The first is, when is testing good enough, and when have you tested enough? For example, when we're writing code and working with libraries, we test and test and test at the beginning, but there comes a point where we decide that that piece of code has been tested enough times that we can now trust it. The second part of that is the impact on downloads, the impact on automatic updates. If we're going to say to people, we've tested that code enough that we now can say it is good enough for you to deploy, we expect them to automatically apply those updates. But as we've seen with SolarWinds, there's clearly a point here where it's not just about the code, it's about the process that sits between the code and its arrival at the end customer. There's a break in the chain here. How do we fix that chain?
That's an excellent question. Ryan, I'm going to defer to you. You're a lot smarter on this aspect of it than I am. Put you on the hot seat here, sir.
Let's break down how this occurred for SolarWinds really quickly and think about where you may have been able to interdict. In this case, SolarWinds, the company, was compromised themselves. We haven't learned exactly how that occurred, but let's assume they got in, had access to their development systems. Once they were on that development system, specifically the build server that was being used to compile the Windows binaries being deployed for SolarWinds Orion, they deployed a Trojan on that system, which CrowdStrike has named Sunspot. The way that operated was it waited until on that system, the MS build process executed. MS build is going to be used to actually go and do the compilation of that binary. At the moment that that happened, it would go and find one of the source code files, the one that they had chosen to modify, swap it with one that they'd modified. They did testing at that time to confirm, is this the same file that we were expecting to swap, or have they potentially added functionality that we're going to break? And if it wasn't going to break, they swapped the file, the compilation continued, then they swapped the files back, and they deleted the modified file they created. It was then compiled, and it went through the rest of the distribution process. If you think about that, the moment where that file changes and it then is deployed, really anything that they did from a source code analysis perspective before the compilation, they weren't going to go and detect it. What they probably needed to have in place was some capability to look at compiled binaries and confirm that they actually matched back to the source code that went into them. This is not an easy problem to solve. There's lots of tools that are available for this kind of source code analysis and binary analysis to make that comparison, but it's not something that every organization is going to have in place. On top of that, remember that what was added to that Orion DLL, the Trojan we call Sunburst, was not inherently malicious just by looking at it. The SolarWinds program itself is a network monitoring solution. Orion reaches out and scans things. It does all sorts of stuff that makes it look a little bit suspicious, which is one of the reasons that SolarWinds guidance, at least at one point, was to turn off antivirus scanning for its DLLs, because it knows that they're going to look like network scanners because that's what they do. That binary that had that additional code that's going to go and beacon to a certain DNS server didn't inherently look suspicious. There's a lot of stealth that went into the development of this. And it's one of the reasons that I'm saying I don't think that we can get to a place where we can all be 100% confident that all software is going to be secure. We've got to build our networks and our systems completely from a defensive perspective, assuming that the software running on them right now is probably already compromised. What would we do today if we had to assume that going forward?
Well, we have techniques that we've talked about many times in the past. We tell people to sign their code. Is there not a point that if you're going to start to make compilations from binaries, that each of those binaries should have been signed code to begin with? That at least forces the attacker to get into your original code to get a correct signature for that binary to be pulled into the final compiled code.
In this case, the Sunburst Trojan was signed. The Orion DLL was signed because they modified the actual source code before it was built into that compilation process. It was compromised at the source code level before the signing ever even occurred. It's as though they sat down with a developer and said, let me type a few thousand lines and I'll just add my own code to this. That's tough to detect unless it did something really outrageous. If it looked like ransomware, where its activity was going to be, I'm going to scan your whole system and encrypt files. That's something that we can detect behaviorally. But as far as a few thousand lines of code that just makes some DNS requests, and then can download and execute a file, that's relatively normal, especially for a piece of software like SolarWinds Orion.
The telltale signs of the SolarWinds breach were those DNS requests. And this is how we started looking after it as the news broke. We were trapping specifically on the DNS requests and a couple of DLL files that we were identifying on our clients' networks. Going back to behavioral analytics, most of the behavioral analytics that is focused today on a network environment is looking at users or software or machine behavior. But does this deviate from the standard that I have benchmarked? There's nothing that I'm aware of, and maybe I'm just a novice on this part of it, but there's nothing that I'm aware of that does analysis on DNS requests. Maybe that's a product offering from Palo Alto that you guys could work on. You're looking at all your DNS requests and say, hey, my SolarWinds Orion server has 99% of the time over the last 12 months gone to this set of DNS or done this set of DNS requests to go to these websites. And now it's going to something different. Why? It could be that simple. But again, it goes back to trusting the software. A key point of this, and we talked about this the other day, is the level of sophistication that went into this particular attack. It's one of those things that I've actually had to say this to a few customers. If somebody wants your stuff bad enough, they're going to find a way to steal it. Whether it's a hacktivist, a threat actor, a nation state, whatever, if they want into your environment or they want to do an attack bad enough, they are going to figure out a way to do it. As we're seeing from the outcome of SolarWinds, there wasn't a timeline that the attackers were forced to comply with. They had plenty of time. They could sit back, take their time, do it right, do it slow, and do it low key, so that when the ultimate attack took place or when the files were pushed into the SolarWinds system, they didn't leave any traces and everybody was scrambling to find that out. It was one of those things where if somebody wants it bad enough, they're going to figure out a way to do it. Then you have to pivot and be ready to respond. That's always been something that we definitely preach at NTT. You can have the biggest, baddest outer candy shell for your network, but there's only so many things that you can do as a defender. You have to be ready to respond, and you have to have good processes in place to respond.
I don't want to give the impression that it's completely impossible to prevent. I think you're right, Scott. There's always an opportunity where you may end up in a response position, but the faster that you can do that and the more automated your response, you get to the point where you may actually be in a prevention position. Palo Alto Networks, we were a SolarWinds Orion customer. We did get the Sunburst Trojan downloaded into our network. We were one of the small few who was targeted by the adversary with an additional payload. The way this attack worked was, after you had Sunburst and you saw these DNS requests, the attacker was able to choose specific organizations and say, do I want to further compromise them? If they chose to do that, they would send down a variant of Cobalt Strike, which I'm sure, Scott, you guys see on a very regular basis. The Cobalt Strike is used by all sorts of adversaries. They could choose to deploy Cobalt Strike. And in each case, that Cobalt Strike binary was unique for each organization who was targeted at its own command and control server. And that's what gave them additional access inside the network. In our case, when the adversary chose to target our Orion server and they sent Cobalt Strike down to it, our endpoint agent, Cortex XDR, detected that the behavior of that system had deviated from normal, identified the binary as Cobalt Strike, and killed it. And at that point, our SOC sprung into action to confirm that there wasn't any additional compromise on the system, that no other SolarWinds servers had been impacted. That's what we determined when we had our own event. This happened at the beginning of October. We didn't connect that back to SolarWinds supply chain compromise because we didn't have those details. For us, this was just a blocked Cobalt Strike beacon, but this was blockable. It wasn't blockable at the point of the actual supply chain compromise where we got Sunburst. That was practically impossible to identify, but it was certainly blockable when they took additional actions. To your point, Scott, as automated response, this was a secondary tool that was being deployed. But having that monitoring in place, having that capability to automatically deploy new protections, that's what kept our system secure in this case. And I want to make sure that people do keep that in mind, that we don't want to just assume everything is going to be compromised. We just need to be back to response because we can get to a point where prevention is still possible.
But how much of that is about competency and education? You saw that, you blocked that because it was out of bounds. A lot of end user companies out there may well have seen the same behavior, but they would have looked at that and said, oh, hang on, that's coming from SolarWinds. Therefore, they're a trusted supplier. This is just a new behavior that we should expect. And therefore, they carry on trusting. Those indicators of compromise take a long time to circulate around the industry for all companies to understand what they should be looking for. How do we speed that up?
This is a place where machines can do a lot of good work for us. If you've got the right data, this is one place when we talk about machine learning, the good guys have a big advantage. We collect a lot of data on what's happening on the system, which enables us to profile systems and say, what's normal, what's not normal. Same is true for networks. that's possible for any organization to deploy with the right technology. It doesn't necessarily require them to have that understanding. I won't say it's perfect. You get false positives, you might generate more noise for your SOC as well. And that's the balance that Scott's been talking about between over-rotating toward let's lock everything down and make it really expensive versus free open environment that you'd have on the other end.
Yeah, Ryan makes a heck of a good point. We walk this path with our clients on a daily basis. Everything's always constantly changing. That's our world. One of the things we've found to further solidify Ryan's point is if you've got a decent technology stack, layer 7 firewall, next generation firewall, pick your vendor that has one, it does not matter, but packet layer inspection, that's pretty well a standard component these days, an endpoint solution that can detect this type of activity and act on it, an EDR, MDR, that is becoming more and more the standard. To Ryan's point, I think he's spot on. When you look at the ability to use machine learning to identify those patterns of behavior and understand very quickly what is different from the norm, let the system do it for you. And if it's identifying something that deviates from the norm, well, immediately your spidey senses should go up, and that should be something your SOC is investigating. And again, to Ryan's point, there is a fair amount of work that goes into this. This stuff is not plug and play by any stretch of the imagination, but it is better than anything that has come before it. By employing these technologies, while there is work to be done with them, it's less work than you would have had to do 5-6 years ago, because the technology is just getting smarter and smarter. And big hats off to Palo Alto with the use of WildFire and maybe being able to shake against the WildFire global database of threats that are observed every day. Your ability to pivot quickly is much, much better because you have access to a large data set, right? And that helps.
There are two groups of customers here that we need to think about. If we think about the pure cloud customer, we can deploy these technologies. We can intercept in the cloud when we upgrade platforms, because at the end of the day, the customer isn't changing the software. They're not applying the patch. That's done for them by the platform owner. So we can afford to bring these technologies into play. We can afford to bring the knowledge and skills into play. But the reality is, vast numbers of customers still retain an awful lot of on-premise equipment. More importantly, their end users are using a mix of mobile devices, desktops, laptops, and everything else. All of those need to be continually patched and therefore stay as the weak link. How do we shift the services that we provide to customers? And I don't just mean the large companies, I mean the small to mid-sized companies who are often financially locked out of taking advantage of some of these services. How do we shift those services to get a wide enough adoption to identify when something is wrong, almost like herd immunity for COVID, for want of a better phrase, so that we significantly limit the impacts?
From a services perspective, that's the trick. Because if we take a step back and we look at the way that the MSS world grew up and continues to grow up, we are feeling a need for the market. The way that the services are designed today, most of them, they are there to fill a gap, fill a void. They're not there to change the dynamic or change the behavior of the players in the market or the users of that market. That's a bit of a shift. For these smaller or medium-sized companies that might be financially locked out from doing some of these things or don't have the funds to go into pure cloud offering, where we've had a lot of success at ATT is we explain the business case. Yes, you can talk about this from an IT perspective until you are blue in the face, but at the end of the day, at some level, for most companies, you're going to be talking to somebody who has a financial background or a pure business background. You have to turn these things into a business case type setup for those folks. Most of those folks exist at the senior leadership space, the decision makers, and they control the checkbook. If you can say to the small and medium companies, look, it's a risk. It's an insurance policy game, but you got to run the numbers on this. We risk losing $10 million if we do not buy the software, move our network into the cloud, or do some of these very tough and expensive things to do. We run the risk of losing roughly $10 million. And to a small and medium business, that's a big deal. You can bankrupt them. Versus if you let me spend $600,000 over the next 12 months to do this incrementally, we get rid of that risk and you can take that risk off the books. That type of setup to the folks that are in charge of most small to medium companies and even the larger companies with that financial or that business background is more palatable to them. You can have all the stats and charts and eye candy you want, but until you put it in dollars and cents, in most cases, it's just not going to resonate.
Let's look at this from a different perspective. We saw, after NotPetya, a significant drop in automatic updating. That was because people were told that what enabled NotPetya to spread was the automatic updates through various servers. How do we prevent a repeat of that drop in updating and patching? Because we really can't afford to have that. It opens a door at a time when companies are still struggling to secure their remote workforce. Any slowdown in that patch process is going to have long-term effects.
I would say it definitely comes down to education and people being aware of the different risks. For those who've chosen to keep running SolarWinds products, they've issued multiple updates for new vulnerabilities since the original exposure of the Sunburst backdoor. If you weren't getting those updates before, then you may not have got Sunburst. If you haven't got them since, you may have another Trojan. The lack of patches doesn't necessarily make the system much less secure. Generally, it's much more likely that your system is going to be compromised through an exposed vulnerability rather than one of these supply chain attacks. You're right, Ian. Over-rotating in this direction could be very problematic for our entire community. If we spend all of our time thinking about how do we stop supply chain attacks to the detriment of how do we stop the business email compromise attacks and the ransomware attacks that are causing most organizations much more pain than SolarWinds ever did, we'll have definitely done a huge disservice to the community for quite a long time.
One of the risks that this type of attack also introduces is we don't know how long some of that code that the attackers put on machines was in place before it was executed. When we roll back in order to fix a problem, we tend to roll back a month, 2 months. How damaging are long-term attacks starting to become where code is left in situ for 3, 6, 9 months before it's executed?
I'd say for this particular case with SolarWinds, we have a good idea of when the systems were compromised originally. We've learned when the code was originally changed, when things were deployed. And I agree with the point that rolling back to a backup from a month ago where the Trojan still exists, that's certainly problematic if that's what you're rolling back to. I don't think this is going to become the norm where we have these sort of software supply chain attacks that go undetected for months and months and months. But I understand that it is certainly a real risk. Part of what it comes down to for many of our customers in responding to this attack was, what kind of log timeline do you have? How far back can you look? When we talked to some customers and said, you need to look back for 12 months at all your DNS requests, we were not going to get a positive response on that. Very few people have that kind of log data, let alone the data for every endpoint to say, have you ever written this file with this particular hash value onto your Orion server? And by the way, look back into middle of 2019, just in case. The data just doesn't exist for most organizations, but I think that's an element of visibility that is necessary with these types of attacks. If you want to be able to have a complete picture of what the impact might have been, you've got to have a very solid amount of data, and it's not a month worth of data. It's probably a year worth of data. It might be 2 years worth of data, and that's a lot to store. Quite frankly, it's something you can only really effectively do with cloud resources. I wouldn't expect anyone to try and manage that on their own network.
You need a data center for your data center.
And you need all the processing power to search it and ideally perform analytics on it. And that is not something you'd expect any company to do on their own. They need good partners for it.
That's where the likes of Palo Alto and the likes of NTT can come in. We have a lot of services that will store clients' log data for a minimum of a year. We can go back 3 years with our current services. And you're absolutely right. Storing that amount of data locally is, wow, that would be a chore. Storing it in the cloud is way cheaper. You can get it for way longer. In a lot of cases, storing it in the cloud allows you a lot of really cool analytics tools to go with it. If you've got a SIEM vendor and you're in their SIEM cloud, or you've got a SIEM and you're dual logging up to an S3 bucket or something like that, it makes it a lot easier to suck that data back down and search it. But you're right. Most customers or most companies simply do not see the need or the benefit to have that much log data until there's a break or there's a hack. And now we have to go searching. Well, we can't search. So now we have to just turn ourselves into circles all over again because we can't identify the exact time or place or date or event where we got this. That's a bad place to be. Ryan, I've got a question for you. A lot of what we do and some of the services we offer is full-blown application scanning. Palo Alto does the same thing. We have a company under our umbrella called White Hat Security. They do application scanning. But most of the application scanning that is done these days is for already installed applications that are either running in a test environment or running in production. Is there, and I'm asking the question because I simply don't know, but is there a way, a service or some piece of technology that you're aware of that can scan binaries to look for deviations from previous versions before you go to install it? Is that something that exists today?
Binary diffing tools definitely exist to identify what has changed. And there is software that's been deployed in this way from a security perspective to say, can we identify if something's been added that has a significantly different functionality? This is something that happens a lot when it comes to app stores, where they're trying to identify whether or not new function has been added to an app so they can determine if it's allowable or not. But I don't know if there's something that works at the scale for every enterprise where they can go and deploy this and say, let's look at all of the binaries before we go and run them. From a scale perspective, it's really, really challenging to make that work. But the underlying technology certainly exists. There's certainly lots of ways that bad guys, when it comes to binary compilation and obfuscation, would try to avoid as well. It's actually one of the biggest challenges when it comes to looking at binaries to understand what their capability is effectively bad guys' versions of digital rights management, where they want to encrypt the file in a way that you can't figure out everything that it does because they want to make it harder for folks like us to detect it. There's legitimate reasons to do that as well, because you don't want industrial espionage to happen and someone to steal your binary and reverse engineer your source code. It's a really complicated environment to be able to understand what truly changed about this binary compared to the last one. But it happens every time Microsoft releases patches because people work really hard to understand what changed. What was that vulnerability that they patched? What new functionality was added? It's just not scalable right now to the entire world.
Is the sort of thing that you might expect a cloud platform owner to put in place for everything they push forwards?
Sure. I can definitely expect that from a cloud provider. In that case, a lot of the code that runs in the cloud is not compiled anyway. You're looking at source code that's running Python as a script or PHP or ASP or whatever else it might be where there isn't an explicit compilation step that occurs because the programming language is interpreted. Because of that, you have the ability to just diff two files, two .py scripts, and say, what really changed here? Now, understanding what does that change mean is a different story itself. Does that DNS request that just went out mean you were talking to a C2 server, or does it just mean it's a DNS request? That's a different layer of understanding.
Here's always the last question of any podcast, and it's the question of three. So from both of you, three reasons why people need to think about supply chain attack, but in such a way that it improves their organization and doesn't become a detriment to other forms of security.
I'll go first. As you're thinking about software supply chain attacks in particular, any changes that you're going to make to your network architecture, make them from the perspective not just of how are we stopping software supply chain attacks, but how are we using this to make our network more secure against all attacks? Because when it comes to visibility, data logging, automation, that works against all of those aspects. If you make those improvements, you're going to stop ransomware just as much as you're going to stop a software supply chain attack. The second thing is inventory is a massive challenge for a lot of entities when it comes to what software is even running inside their network. The big question for everyone responding to SolarWinds is, do we use SolarWinds? Do we even use that product? So that's another aspect of visibility. Having a full understanding of what your deployment is absolutely crucial. Finally, also on the realm of visibility, and this is true for software supply chain as well as for other kinds of attacks, you may not even know what your organization owns or is responsible for that's attached to the internet. Having that sort of telemetry and inventory from the outside in to say, are you running a SolarWinds server? Are you running an RDP server? What are you running in your IP space? What do you look like from an attacker's perspective is helpful both for software supply chain as well as for just generally securing your network.
Yeah, good points. For me, it's all about just knowing your environment. A lot of the points Ryan made, I'm going to regurgitate, but in a different flavor. It's knowing who you do business with for sure, having that visibility. Who are my suppliers? For the suppliers that you heavily depend on, you get 100% of the things you do not ask for. So ask the question, what is your software security lifecycle? Can we ask you questions about this? Can you exhibit some evidence that gives us the confidence to say, yes, you guys are doing the things that you need to do. You're giving us a reasonable amount of protection with this software code. Second thing is going to be visibility, to Ryan's point. It's going to be having the visibility within your environment. These things are easy to say, very hard to do. It's a layered approach. That's why there's no one magic piece of software or technology out there. It's a layered approach. You want to know what's in your environment. You want to constantly be doing scanning and patching, the least sexy aspects of IT, but they are the most important. You want to constantly be scanning and searching your environment. I have a new endpoint. This is different from yesterday. My software inventory changed. It's constantly asking the question of why when you see something and walking that backwards until you have a full understanding. The last thing is going to be just education. Ryan made this point earlier, but it's educating your workforce so that they know what to look for. Are they ever going to be a cybersecurity expert? Is your salesperson going to be a cybersecurity expert? Of course not. But arming them with enough information to say, hey, if you see your mouse moving and you're not moving it, you might want to turn off your computer and call us. Or, hey, your background screen changed, something's up. Or, hey, all your files are encrypted. You definitely have a problem. Do not sit on this. Call us immediately. And again, it's the layered approach of all of these things. None of them are easy, but all of them are worth doing. Otherwise, you're just going to leave yourself open to be the next person that shows up on the front page of the news.
I think from my perspective, the one thing that I'm really hoping is we don't see those overreactions and we don't see people shutting down automatic updates because we need them at the moment desperately. Thank you both very much for talking to me here. There's an awful lot there to think about.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Ian.